Hello, everyone, and welcome to the In Defense of Plants podcast, the official podcast of indefenseofplants.com. What's up? This is your host, Matt. Welcome to the show. How is everyone doing this week? I'm doing great because we are talking about two of the coolest and two of some of the rarest oaks in North America. Today, we are talking about Boynton or Alabama sandstone oak and Georgia oak, both of which grow in really harsh conditions, rock outcrop kind of habitats, and they're very, very special trees, but they're also extremely mysterious trees that are in desperate need of more scientific investigation. Joining us to talk about this is curator and plant conservationist and all-around great dude, Patrick Thompson, who you have definitely heard on the podcast before if you've been listening for a while. The last time he was on, we talked about azaleas, but this time we're talking about oaks and oak conservation, specifically about these two species that are just fantastic. And I can't think of anyone better than Patrick because he just spends so much time working with himself and others to try to protect these plants. But conversations like this don't happen unless you support the show. And there's a lot of great ways to do that. One of the best is to become a patron over at patreon.com/indefenseofplants. For a tiny contribution each month, you get a lot of great kickbacks, including access to bonus episodes, while at the same time keeping In Defense of Plants up and running. I couldn't be doing it without all my patrons. But that is entirely enough for me. I don't want to steal any more of your time with my rambling. Let's go learn about two really cool, really rare oaks. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Patrick Thompson. I hope you enjoy. All right. The great and mighty Patrick Thompson is here. Welcome back to the podcast, buddy. It is so good to have you here. For those that haven't heard your previous episode, which they should do right after listening to this one, let's start off with an introduction. Tell everyone a little bit about who you are and what it is you do.
Well, thanks for having me, Matt. Glad to be back. I am the curator of special collections with 2/3 of my time every week at the Davis Arboretum at Auburn University. And then the other 1/3 of my appointment is as the coordinator of the Alabama Plant Conservation Alliance. And so the Plant Conservation Alliance is doing species-focused projects to prevent extinction. And then the Arboretum is a native plant collection focusing on plants of Alabama and adjacent states, primarily trees, but also woody shrubs and some herbaceous plants. And so there's a few projects that overlap both of them nicely.
Nice.
So excited to talk to you about some of those today.
Excellent. And I will say, before we get into the meat of our discussion, for plant people that I know, few people are as steeped in their everyday, every waking moment, sort of everything you're doing seems to be really good stuff for plants, enjoying plants. You seem so immersed in it. And I know it wasn't necessarily where you got your foot in the door, but for those, again, that haven't heard sort of your backstory, how did plants just consume you the way they have?
I was a zoology student here at Auburn University and took an evolution and systematics course with Dr. George Folkerts, who in my mind was a famous herpetologist. And I was excited to get close to him and have some of his genius rub off on me if I was lucky. But it turned out that he was an actual genius and understood all of the working parts of the planet, had a map of everything in his head and the evolutionary history of plants and animals and how everything was intertwined. And so in his evolution and systematics course, I could keep up with him when he was talking about animals, specifically reptiles and amphibians, but most of the story had to do with all of the other parts. And so I realized that plants were just a huge knowledge gap for me. And then I got a job at the Arboretum as a student worker and got hooked on native plants because, you know, you can go out in the woods looking for snakes and get skunked, but there was always a plant to be found.
Yeah, yeah. I hear you loud and clear because I can't seem to find any cool snakes anytime I go out. And I know you suffered from similar issues.
Mm-hmm.
But
I got lucky finding the plants, so yeah. Stuck with it.
And it's so great that you have, because you're working in one of North America's biodiversity hotspots. Alabama has amazing diversity of all walks of life, but plants are really underappreciated everywhere. And, you know, Alabama's got some really special ones, which is why we are conversing here again today, because for the last, you tell us how many years, you have really been hitting the ground hard for a lot of oak species, but two in particular are really near and dear to your heart, to my heart, and that's Quercus boyntonii and Quercus georgiana. Georgia oak, obvious to know how it got that name, but Alabama sandstone oak, or Boynton oak, as it's sometimes known. Wow. Can I just begin to say, like, very special species?
Yeah, they are easily overlooked, but once you get to know them, they are really enigmatic and exist kind of on this human scale, you know, being dwarf oaks that are, you know, usually about our height. You can kind of look them in their eye and put your arms around them and, you know, feel for them because they're out there living a tough life, usually on sandstone outcrops. The Georgia oak also occurs on granite outcrops. But I've been paying close attention to them since about 2008, 2009. Wow. I was aware of the Georgia oak before that, but when the Arboretum tried to get its oak collection accredited, the reviewer that came down and looked at our oak collection said that, you know, this Quercus boyntonii does not have a champion or an expert. And if you're going to have an oak collection in Alabama, then this needs to be the thing you know the most about. And that was Todd Lassane, who at the time came from many states away, but now he's in Alabama working at Bellengrath Gardens. Huh. And so I've been able to reconnect with him. He was here just a couple weeks ago and got to walk around and see what the place looked like 15 years after he made these recommendations.
Wow. That's so excellent. That had to feel really good, because I know you've been doing a lot of hard work for, you know, an arboretum is, especially one that is really aesthetically pleasing and welcoming, not an easy thing to develop over time. And it's great that you've kind of been there throughout your career to see this place evolve and then show it off to people like him. But, you know, it's funny that you had heard of georgiana before, and Boynton oak or Alabama sandstone oak is far more near and dear to really your stomping grounds, right? Like, this is something that even people that grew up in the narrow area where it's native and endemic don't really know about.
Yeah, and, you know, one of the first stumbling blocks is that Boynton oak just doesn't evoke much, and Alabama sandstone oak is kind of a mouthful. So for the rest of the interview, you want to call them Q-boys?
Yeah, I think Q-boy and Georgia, whatever we want to, it's a little easier. Georgia oak might be.
Yeah, I like QGO.
QGO and Q-boy, let's do that. I like that.
Yep. And so, exactly. And so I grew up on Shades Mountain in just south of Birmingham, on sandstone outcrops, and then found out that, of course, Oak Mountain was a place that had them. So that was where I first met them face to face, and then realized that they looked a lot like the ones that were, in fact, in the woods I grew up playing in. And we discovered them at Moss Rock Preserve. Literally my parents' backyard had a tree in it. So yeah, Q-boys weren't plentiful, but they were right under my nose the whole time.
Yeah. And QGO makes its way into that neck of the woods as well, even though it is a little bit more, or I guess would say less soil or edaphic specific. It still likes these dry outcrops. But within a stone's throw of your stomping grounds, you could see both species, hypothetically, if you know what to look for.
Yep, but neither of them had been reported from that area, even years after it had been designated as a city park and had a lot of traffic through it. And same even for Oak Mountain State Park. Even the park naturalists knew about it, but there was a necessary effort to do a formal survey and make reports to the Alabama Natural Heritage Program and get the information in front of the right people.
Which is wild to think about because, yeah, they're dwarf oaks, but they're not an obscure little forb or grass or sedge or something tucked away that requires a ton of expertise to tease apart and an eye for detail to find. I mean, you can find these things if you go outside. I've even seen you point from the car and say, hey, look at that. And once you get an eye for them, but it just goes to show you that in the plant world, in areas that are insanely biodiverse like Alabama, it is still so easy for people to just, everything's been discovered, why do we bother? Or plants are boring, let's forget about it and move on.
Right. And, you know, oaks are ubiquitous throughout the state. You know, everybody has an oak tree in their yard. So nobody knows what kind they are. They just know they have an oak tree. And that's good enough for most people. And so a dwarf oak is just another oak, a small oak. And, you know, when there's 39, 40 species of oaks native to the state of Alabama and hybridization occurring between white oaks and between red oaks, then it really is a challenging place to identify things down to species. So even though plant people can find them, most of the land in Alabama is private. And so, you know, it's not getting eyes on it. So right. It's an interesting challenge to get Alabamians interested in this little dwarf oak to recognize it on their property.
And so with that in mind, I mean, obviously pictures are at least for people like me, way easier to kind of get your head wrapped around. But, you know, what does Q-Boy look like? What does Q-Geo look like? How are these, at least have some features that you can kind of pluck out and go, okay, I might have something here.
There are some distinctive features on the Q-Boys with that leaf shape having three lobes and widest out towards the apex of the leaf. And the problem is that there's overlap between similar species, like the sandpost oak, Quercus margarita, especially in a fire-prone community. Then you're going to have a fire response that looks like a stoloniferous dwarfy oak, and the lobing can definitely be more than three in Q-Boy and less than the typical 5 to 7 in the sandpost. So it's that overlap where things get confusing.
Certainly.
And I think QGO, on the other hand, just sticks out like a sore thumb once you get to know it. It has a very specific shade of green and a style of lobing, nice and symmetrical and blocky and small leaves. It stands out against most of the other red oaks
nice.
A lot better than I think Q-Boy does.
Nice. So as you mentioned at the beginning, you know, you're wearing a bunch of different hats. You know, you're doing a lot for the Arboretum to showcase plants, put together aesthetically pleasing gardens, and, you know, do the horticultural side of things. While at the same time, you also have your strong plant conservation hat on, trying to save species from extinction. And boy, these are two extremely rare oaks that are threatened with extinction. So, you know, from the beginning, how do you, in your professional opinion, like what was the key to kind of blending the approach to, hey, we want to showcase this. Okay, go get a couple. Well, a couple's not a conservation collection. How did you start to plug yourself into really both sides of this way of appreciating these trees?
Well, I want to give credit to, again, that review from the Association of the Public Gardens of America with their plant collections network that they built up. It's based on having conservation quality plant collections. And so they linked me up with resources from Botanic Garden Conservation International and the Center for Plant Conservation. And both of those have a decent little array of publications on how to maximize the conservation value of a collection. And so fortunately for us, we are a small arboretum with a tight mission statement. And so having oaks as our flagship collection and Alabama oaks as a focus, this dwarf oak made a lot of sense because it was something that we could have multiple specimens of on display without, you know, crowding out a lot of other collections. And so this one was a unique opportunity to display a large amount of diversity within the collection, but we quickly realized that it had to get spread out through this larger meta collection of gardens to, for one thing, not have all the eggs in one basket.
Sure.
But for another thing, just to get these plants in other people's hands so they can recognize them and keep them safeguarded, because it's a unorthodox seed. The recalcitrant seeds of oaks cannot be stored in a traditional seed bank. And so they have to be maintained for safeguarding in living collections.
Right. Well, and I think the other benefit too is not everyone is afforded the luxury, the travel stipends, the grants needed to go study this species in situ. Should still desperately does need to happen for both species to understand their ecology better. But these distributed metaconservation collections, you know, they're really keeping genetics alive, diversity alive, but it does give people the opportunity to study them in more detail, figure out what is the breadth of their growth or, you know, plasticity and in sort of preferences or habit, you know, all the number of things you can do by just getting to know a plant by growing it.
Yeah. And you know that we're trying to gather as many data points as we can just to really understand the natural history of the species, because it's hasn't been well documented or observed. So there's an opportunity to really write the book on this species with the work that's being done, you know, at numerous institutions with the species. So,
yeah. Yeah. And I mean, you can't overemphasize how little is known about species like cuboy. I mean, you go looking in the literature and it's like, it was found here, might have been found in Texas, but for all intents and purposes, still only exists now in the wild in Alabama. But beyond that, there's so little. I mean, some genetic work has been done, but the natural hit, I mean, you have seen so many weird things just out looking for this tree, let alone doing acorn collections, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and it's really one of the most dynamic tree species that I've ever encountered. You know, it can be a crawling stoloniferous mat just a few inches high, or a single trunk tree that can either be very vertical and narrow or low and wide. And typically it's somewhere in between, usually a multi-stem shrubby kind of thing, but it's going to be interesting to try to map out the life cycle of this plant, you know, whether it's prone to starting out as a stoloniferous thing that then finds a spot, or if that's, you know, whether it's nature or nurture is, you know, a big old question. And so sending it out to these gardens, it's not exactly a common garden experiment, but it is a way to see how they will grow. Certainly. In different places.
Yeah. And, you know, the other interesting part too is it is so, you know, cuboy at least is so narrowly distributed current day. QGO is a little bit more widespread. Would you say that's lended to a slightly better understanding, or is it as enigmatic as cuboy?
Well, I think one of the things that's helped with a better understanding is the recognizability of it. But it does run through a few more states than just one. And, you know, Georgia has a wonderful botanical history with lots of great folks doing a lot of work documenting things around there. And then it goes into South Carolina as well. And so I think being other places besides Alabama is a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it certainly is. But, you know, in thinking about the work you've done within Alabama for both these species, as you mentioned, and is the case for so many other rare species, most of them are occurring on private lands. And, you know, you don't want to just go collect from the handful of publicly owned or government protected sites. You got to kind of get some breadth. And so how has, you know, being a resident of Alabama, growing up there, knowing people, like, has that helped you seek out other people, other landowners, other institutions that might be willing to improve, you know, or help build these collections?
Yeah, there's a really good community of botanists that communicate within Alabama. And so they were ready to share information with me. And then it's really a situation by situation, you know, gambit of possibilities. You know, you can meet somebody walking down the street that, you know, wants to ask you a tree question because you're carrying a shovel. You know what I mean? It's just like, it could be as random as that. Or the mayor of Hoover could make a note about this thing because he saw it on the news. And then next thing you know, people are calling you saying they got in your yard and a new population is discovered. Just like that. Yeah. And so, you know, I think the, I wish I could say that it was my Alabama relations that made it easier. It maybe makes me a little more able to talk to people, you know, walking up and knocking on doors. But that's one thing that we do is we send out just letters to landowners, asking if we can come visit.
Yeah.
And let them know where we're from. So, yeah, there's cold calls. There's people who know people who, you know, think they saw a thing. And so then you go hunting down these Sasquatch-like cryptids out there on the rock outcrops. And they're usually water oaks, you know, sometimes sassafras.
Yeah, yeah, I've seen that one. Sometimes they're blurry, just like Sasquatch, because they're hybrids and you can't quite tell who the parents were, or you have some ideas, but you just kind of go, I don't know, let's send a leaf off to someone that can do some genetic work.
Well, and sometimes that's the photographer too, making it blurry. So you gotta, you gotta work on the quality you're getting there.
Yeah. But, you know, especially when you start getting into rural areas, you could see why saying, hey, you've got something rare and endangered. Now, it doesn't have federal protection, nor does QGO, I believe. Saying that to folks might raise the hair on the back of their neck and suddenly thinking like, uh-oh, is something going to happen to my land? But so much of what you try to communicate, and I think you've been really effective of, is the more work you do to conserve the species, the less worry they can have. So let's talk about that a little bit. Like, why are you putting in so much effort to maybe go check out something that very well could be a sassafras or a water oak?
Well, I think that there's a lot of potential for the recovery of this species. And if it were recognized by the Fish and Wildlife Service as endangered, then it would probably have a recovery plan that would say something about, you know, bolstering naturally occurring populations and, you know, getting plants back on the ground in areas where they used to live. And so for Cuboy, that's basically the Birmingham metropolitan area. The range of the species is primarily from just south of Birmingham to northeast of Birmingham. And so we have a large metropolitan area right there on top of it. So it's an effort to get people to realize it's out there, to find the things that are still existing on the land. But then one of my favorite efforts has been a seed orchard that we're developing with the U.S. Forest Service up in North Carolina, where we've got rows and rows of these cuboys planted out, hoping that they will grow up and make seed within a reasonable time, and we'll be able to have plants that could be shared back with the people of Birmingham to get trees back within their native range.
Nice. Right. And, you know, again, the benefit of having worked in the public garden community on the conservation of the species is, or both species, is you get to see that these things can do well when planted, right? It doesn't need to go exactly where that thing originated in this really specific outcroppy sort of habitat. Now, there are limits to this, obviously, but this is something that can be cultivated down the line. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they exist out on these sandstone outcrops, not because they require sandstone outcrops to grow on, but because they can outcompete something like a white oak that wants to be 100 feet tall, which would then blow over out on a rock outcrop because there's not enough soil to hold up a tree of that size. And so when these acorns do get taken off into the woodlands by squirrels or blue jays or whatever, where they can then germinate in deep shade off the outcrops, then they're outcompeted by those larger trees in the deeper soil. And so they can grow elsewhere if you make a hole in the canopy for them, which is what a lot of Alabama's rare plants end up needing. So there's there's a lot of saw work for most of these rare plants.
That's a really good point too, is a lot of times it could be alarming for folks, say they were just passing by one of your restoration sites, where sometimes you are cutting native plants, but there's changes in the forest going on that we have wrought on the landscape. Some are extreme, like building buildings and paving things and bulldozing things, but others are a little bit more subtle or sinister, even where you preclude fire and maybe plant too many privet. And suddenly, like you said, you've got this hyper competitive landscape that so many of the rare plants in this neck of the woods desperately require to be managed for.
Yeah, and it is, you know, a long list of plants that need attention. And so I'm glad I've been able to focus on cuboys pretty well. And it has afforded us a lot of information, but also a lot of conservation opportunities have opened up. And so it's been exciting to get out there and knock down some of that privet and other stuff.
Yeah, because that's a lot of what you have been doing since, you know, we've really started talking about these projects is, you have to clear out these invasive species. And that's what's fascinating too, is you see these habitats, you know, walking on a granite or a sandstone outcrop in the dead of August is like walking on a fully stoked charcoal grill. It's brutal. Okay. And I generally don't think of brutal habitats as having invasive species issues, but boy, they are rampant in some of these pockets, and trying to free up that landscape, which is more open, is a big part of what you're doing on the ground for both species, really, but Cuboy in a big way.
Mm-hmm. And the linear nature of these rock outcrops along the ridge and valley is something that I hadn't really considered until I was putting a talk together last week for a talk for the Alabama Invasive Plant Council, talking about managing privet on these sandstone rock outcrops. And we do find cuboys out in the open part of these outcrops, but they do better along the margins, you know, and where they can get their feet in a little bit, and so does the privet. And so we have these walls of privet at some of these properties, which if you have a wide open glade, then that edge effect isn't as bad. But some of our ridge and valley rock outcrops are very linear. They might only be 25 feet across, but you know, a half mile long. And so there's a lot less interior opportunity for them to live in. And margins are getting pressured, you know, at a higher rate because privet need a little bit of foot in the moisture, but then they just keep crawling out and expanding their root zone and actually chewing up these glades, making them even more narrow.
Wow, that is wild to think about, sort of the geological accident that creates this scenario where, you know, invasion is really well situated and then the rare stuff is really well situated in a different way. Huh. Oh, man, that's upsetting. Because, yeah, you see an outcrop, they're not, they are capable of growing in some harsh conditions, but not out of solid stone. So, yeah, it's those pockets, but then those pockets where everything else is trying to vie for it. So, wow, that's does that change when you learn things like this? I mean, does that kind of change your outlook as someone managing and thinking about conservation?
Well, and it kind of changed my attack plan for making sure some of these better cuboy populations are managed, is that those linear, narrow glades really need to become a focus to make sure that they don't get squished out quicker than some of these other things that are on larger glade systems.
Yeah, I guess it helps at the very least prioritize. And, you know, what's also neat is, I guess, the more private landowners you meet, you get to see different conditions, A, where these trees can grow, but also conditions where, okay, how does this behave when not choked out? How does it behave and moderately choked out? Like, that's the other part, is context. You get to see a lot of different contexts by working across the landscape with private, public, and everyone in between.
Yeah, and with this species, getting to understand that context is really unique opportunity, because for, you know, almost any other oak species, the possibility of seeing all of them is almost impossible. But with cuboy, when we started working with it, the estimated population for the total species was 200 individuals.
Dang.
And so at that point, it was, you know, totally feasible to see every plant and measure every plant and map every plant. And so, you know, a decade later, we've found a lot of plants, and the total population is up over 1,800. I think 1,824 is the last number we had. But that's still, you know, a small enough amount that you can see every tree and map every tree. And so that's a goal, to really get a snapshot of this species on the landscape at this time.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it is wild to think about. It's exciting, but also it's daunting and it's scary because, you know, 1,800, like you said, it's not a lot when you think of A, the amount of counties it's in, and B, the amount of threats it's facing. And so, you know, you talk about development, you talk about invasive species. 1,800 can go away, you know, alarmingly quick, because so much more has to, I mean, what they say, the passenger pigeon was billions and it no longer exists. So it is a cautionary tale, but, you know, do you find that when you do meet people, even if they're not nature-oriented people, are they excited about this idea? Do you find a lot of, like, receptivity to, oh, hey, there's this cool thing?
I'd say more often than not, I do.
Yeah.
People think it's neat. They're excited to learn that they have a special little thing, and they're glad to know that it's a tough thing because it is. It is. They don't really have to do much. Just, you know, we can usually offer to come help push some things back. You know, we have partners like the International Oak Society and the Morton Arboretum that have provided funding to allow us to do this research and manage these invasive plants out in the wild. And so we can actually manage invasive species on somebody's property with relatively few strings attached. You know, we can, and that's one of the main things that we can make a difference in.
Yeah.
There's other larger threats like climate change and extreme weather events that are a little harder for us to communicate with the landowner any, you know, potential way to get around that other than let us collect some acorns and at least the genetics can be preserved somewhere else.
Yeah.
And so the life out on the sandstone outcrops in these shallow soil pockets has always been challenging for them, but with extreme heat and dry events that, you know, we haven't been around for the entire history of the species, so we don't exactly have a data set to compare it to, but we know that it is very hot and very dry out there, and hotter than drier than we've recorded in recent history.
Yeah.
So I think it's a worthwhile effort to get some acorns collected and get them established in places like North Carolina in some deep soil where climate predictions say that, you know, that area will be like Alabama and, you know, Southern Canada will be like the Appalachians are now. Ugh. So, yeah.
Yeah. I always get it sets me back every time you think about those projections. But, you know, and that's the other part of it, too, is it's a collaborative effort. It's a recorded effort, you know, and it's not just shooting from the hip, a bunch of people trying to do the right thing, but doing it in a way that isn't, you know, you don't have a lot of baseline or any information to go on. This is a collaborative effort, a lot of data being shared, and new ideas are constantly kind of spinning off all the time. I know you recently got involved through Q-Boy and Georgiana and all these other oaks, actually, in a big hybridization. Like, while you're out there doing things, you can collect data for others, collect actual samples for others to do this important research to fill in a mere fraction of the unknowns that exist for oaks like these.
Right. And that hybridization grant is evaluating hybrids in the wild, but primarily in collections. And so if we go out and we collect acorns off of a tree, we know that that tree is the mother of that embryo. But we also know that that father would have blown in on the wind, as it were. And so in the wild, surely we would have paternal Q-boys and maternal Q-boys making pure-blooded Q-boys out there to continue the species. But things have changed recently, and so there's fewer populations, less connectivity, and we don't know if the acorns that we're picking are likely to be hybrids or not. Yeah. So we have to do genetic analysis of these seedlings that are growing from the acorns we collected to ensure the fidelity of the conservation work that we're doing.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And when you think of the possibilities and how rare things, it's especially wind pollinated things, it's a law of large numbers. And when you are so outnumbered by neighboring oak species and, you know, there's no more fire in some of these habitats or disturbance of the historic regime that allow other more abundant oaks to grow, those odds seem to start going up, or at least you'd think they were. But that's why it is so important to send these leaves off so that geneticists can do that work while you are busy cutting privet and sweet gums and all other manner of things that are truly encroaching on these very sensitive habitat types.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. And so, you know, having seen so many of Q-boy and Q-geos, I mean, how do you personally relate to these trees after all of these years of working with them? I mean, you've seen so much breadth. I know you've got individuals you particularly love and enjoy. It's, you got to have so many cool, you know, just encounters with a sessile organism.
Yeah. And I have probably just a whole bunch of curiosity and awe and wonder as I encounter them and wonder what they have seen and wonder, you know, how much older are those roots than those stems?
Right.
You know, or is this an individual? And one of my favorite individuals was at Oak Mountain State Park. It was one of the very first ones I was introduced to and, you know, said, this is Q-Boy. And I had my young son with me and we had pictures with the thing. And in the decades since, it declined. And it was one of these large single stem individuals that, you know, when it was full grown, it was maybe 9 feet tall. And in this same site, we had done a core sampling to age the trees and had found the oldest one on the site was 250 years old.
Wow.
And this was a 5-inch diameter stem. You know, so just hoping that this one stem that I had met was going to die and then have new shoots come up and have a whole new life in a different stage or shape, but it didn't. It just passed off into heat and rot. Dang. And watched it go. And we haven't sampled that trunk and it's still standing.
Okay.
And you know, maybe we'll apply for a permit to cut a cookie out of it and count the rings on that one, because it would be another important data point in understanding the natural history and life cycles of the tree.
Man, it's so sobering to hear that though, from people like you, because you have spent so much of your life on trying to just do something for these trees. Right. And you spend a lot of time looking at them, reading about them, working with others, collaborating. It just really underscores how much we don't know and how much we still have yet to learn about a species that you could be, you know, in so many ways intimately familiar with, but it's like having a best friend that never tells you anything about their background.
Yeah, there is lots of room in the pages of this book to be filled in.
Yeah.
You know, and knowing how big they get, how long they live, how often they reproduce successfully. You know, these are important things for someone attempting to do conservation of a species that we're just still in the information gathering point of this.
Well, and the other cool thing is a strange silver lining to the lack of protections is this is a species calling out for a grad student or two or three or a team of researchers to come and do all manner of insights and investigations into this, both of these oaks. And you know, it's made a little bit more easy by being able to just reach out to landowners and not have to jump through endless amounts of permitting and stuff to kind of get the government red tape removed. Not to say that that's not important, but get it now, do this research and contribute while the species is still in that fighting back phase so that we don't let it get to that point where, oh no, it's too late.
Right, right. And, you know, one of the big things oaks have gotten credit for in recent years is their, you know, interaction with lepidopterans and all types of gall wasps and midges and all these other little biological interactions. I mean, every one of those groups is a dissertation that would be a feather in the hat of Q-Boy, showing how it interacts with the world. But yeah, horticultural protocols, the list goes on.
Exactly. So with that in mind, I mean, for someone on the ground doing the work, how do listeners that care, that even if they don't live anywhere near the Southeast, how do they help missions like this? What do they do to help you, help Q-Boy, help QGO? Like, what can they do to pitch in and find out more even?
Well, I would say there's a few different ways that they could come at it.
Cool.
We, of course, accept donations here at the Davis Arboretum, and you can earmark that for Q-Boy research. We have a large Q-Boy exhibit coming along soon.
Excellent.
And we have been patiently waiting for a tree to move on, and it did. Large red hickory.
Okay.
You know, just crunched up and died last summer, and then next to it was a sweet gum that had the top knocked out of it. And so that opened up a hole in our canopy, which is what we've been waiting for to really build this exhibit. And so
excellent.
We're going to have our own sandstone outcrop here at the Arboretum one day.
Yes.
But then there's so many other groups. I've mentioned that the International Oak Society has supported our efforts. And the Alabama Plant Conservation Alliance doesn't really have any funding. We exist to just give a forum for plant conservation folk of all walks to get together and make sure nothing's falling through the cracks. So it really is a hands-on way for local people to get involved from a distance, communicate with public gardens. That's where we're at, is mostly working with gardens on distribution of these plants out to other places where they can grow. Hopefully one day that seed orchard will get up off the ground, be producing acorns at a phenomenal rate. And then it would be possible for other people to bring these cuboids into their landscape. But currently, I don't think going out and trying to buy a cuboid is anything that's going to help it, because creating a market for something that doesn't produce enough acorns to keep its own population up is a risky proposal.
I'm glad you say that, because inevitably, every time I do one of these episodes, I get at least a handful of emails from mostly well-intentioned collectors that say, like, how can I get seed? And you're like, just chill. let some conservation work happen before we get to that point.
Yeah, and so one thing that we found is a very small number of adult plants reproducing a significant amount of acorns in any given year.
Yeah.
And again, we're about 10 years into keeping records on how often plants are producing seed, and have really good records from a few years of work. And we definitely haven't seen that mast year where they produce a lot of acorns, and they might never do that. What we're seeing is more like 5% of the trees we look at develop more than 10 acorns in a given year. And so a lot of trees will have one or two or three, but the probability of those surviving are pretty small.
Yeah.
And so I wouldn't really consider those reproductive individuals in a given year. But yeah, just about 5% of them put on enough to have an actual chance of surviving. So going out and collecting acorns is something we do in a very controlled, you know, planned, regimented.
Right. Communicated with others.
Communicated. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's the knife edge out there in so many different ways for so many different species. And, you know, if you ever get a chance to explore, you know, cuboid or QGO habitat, you're going to see a lot of other cool stuff alongside of it. But Patrick, if people want to find out more about you, are you present on the internet? And it's okay if you're not, but where do you recommend they go to find out more about your work?
Well, I would definitely say that the Davis Arboretum here at Auburn University has been a wonderful seat. I've been here for 20 years, full time, working for the garden. And so you can see my work and the Alabama Plant Conservation Alliance projects on our page. And yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah, that's the spot.
Awesome.
Well, you can get the APCA Facebook page and the Davis Arboretum Facebook and Instagram accounts. And, you know, we do other cool stuff, like show up for drones flying over and shooting fire into pitcher plant bogs. And there's all types of exciting conservation work going on here in Alabama that we're a part of.
Excellent. Well, Patrick, you and your team are fantastic. Nature in general, but plants specifically, have such a friend in all of your efforts and all of your calendar timing and scheduling. So thank you for everything that you do. Thank you so much for taking time to talk with us about it, and thanks for being a good guy at the end of the day.
Thanks, Matt. I do my best. Plants inspire me.
Of course. Well, it's good inspiration, but in the meantime, stay healthy. We need you out there.
All right.
Cheers.
Thanks again.
All right, fantastic stuff. The world is truly a better place with people like Patrick in it. I can't thank him enough for taking time out of his busy schedule to talk with us, as well as all of the effort and work he puts into not only protecting and conserving plants, but helping display the marvels of native plants to the public in really cool, aesthetically pleasing ways. As always, if you want to learn more about what we talked about today, go check out the show notes over at indefensiveplants.com. Just navigate to the episode and check out all of the links I put in there where you can learn more. And as I mentioned, look at all the ways you can help keep this show up and running, because In Defense of Plants does not happen without your support. You can pick up a copy of my book, some of our customizable merch and stickers. You can also become a patron over at patreon.com/indefensibleplants. But that is it for this week. I thank you all for listening. Make sure you hit that subscribe button and keep checking back in. But until next time, hang in there, stay healthy, and get outside if you can. This is your host, Matt, signing out. Adios, everyone.